I love that. If you don't know what crystallize is, you will know by the end of the half hour. We are going to crystallize your love for the music of our first guest. And, you know, it's funny because I was leaving my house tonight, coming to the studio, as I always do. I said goodbye to my kids and my wife and went up to my little dog, Fuzzy, and I gave Fuzzy a little hug. And I noticed on Fuzzy's neck, she has a little pendant on her neck, and I knew the pendant was there, but I read it tonight, and I hadn't read it for a long time. She's only 2 years old. It says, "I'm kind of a big deal," and I walked out thinking, yeah, she is kind of a big deal, and then I turned my attention to the show, and I'm thinking, you know, my first guest is really a big deal. She's kind of a big deal. Really a big deal. She is an electronic violinist, songwriter, and dancer, one of the most innovative stars out there today. She's got 13 million plus YouTube subscribers, 3 billion with a B, billion plus views on YouTube, 3.4 million TikTok followers. She's won 2 Billboard Music Awards. She was number 4 on the Forbes YouTube artist list in 2015 and the highest ranking woman on that list. She has headline tours that have performed to audiences over 800 million. She was runner-up of season 25 of Dancing with the Stars, was a finalist on America's Got Talent, and she co-wrote with her sister Brooke Passy a New York Times best-selling book. Wow, the only pirate at the party is the book. It's incredible, all of the accolades. In 2017, she released her first ever holiday album called Warmer in the Winter, and that was number one for a Christmas album. And now we get a new Christmas album called Snow Waltz. It comes out on October 7th, and it will be part of the Snow Waltz Christmas tour, which is starting soon. Going to be hopefully by a city near you. And she has been just a sensation without a doubt. And of course, I'm talking about Lindsay Sterling. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I'm blushing over here from your accolades. Thank you for saying all those nice things.
Wait a second here, Lindsay. You say my accolades? This is all you. It's incredible what you have accomplished in a short period of time. You've done so much, and it's groundbreaking. Tell us what has been most enjoyable about your ascent into being just a superstar.
Oh, well, thank you again. You know, and I just did a show last night. I've been doing, you know, kind of a string of shows here, and we had our last one last night before we kick off Christmas in a few months. And, you know, the answer to that question is, honestly, it hasn't changed since I started. The reason I wanted to, like, pursue this journey of, like, being a performer, writing music, starting a YouTube channel, doing all these things was purely I wanted to entertain. I wanted to make people smile. I wanted to bring light to people's lives. And as I stood on stage last night or danced around on stage last night, you know, just staring into the eyes of these people in the audience and feeling that connection, I was like, this is still the most rewarding and most, like, special thing that I get to do. And it's, like I said, it's been the same since day one when I started.
You know, it's interesting you say make people smile. And what you do really makes people smile. Because you aren't simply the classical violinist. And of course, a lot of people smile when they're at orchestra performances. But more often than not, they're relaxed, they're contemplative, they ruminate. But you really are so exciting that people have these faces. It's almost in awe. How did you come up with these ideas? Because you're trained classically, but to be able to bring in a whole new audience of a lot of young people who may not have been exposed to this kind of music until you kind of pumped it up and made it real and made it 2020.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, it, like you said, I was classically trained, and I always kind of thought, you know, maybe someday I'll be a professional violinist and I'll, you know, join an orchestra or something. And but when I was about ready to study music in college, I was about to be a performance major. I just became very aware all of a sudden that I was very burnt out and that music and violin, it didn't bring me joy anymore. And that was heartbreaking because I'd played the violin since I was 6 years old. It was a huge part of my, not only my life, but my identity. And I was like, well, I don't want to quit, but this doesn't make me happy anymore. And so I switched majors. I ended up studying film, and I set out on this journey to kind of rediscover what could make me fall in love again with the violin. And I thought, well, I should play the kind of music that I enjoy. And at the time, I was really into dubstep and electronic music and some rock. And so I started just combining all these elements. And you know, and I'm just at my core a very creative person. That's what really keeps me going and keeps me excited. It's not the violin. It's not any one aspect of it. It's the fact that I get to wake up every morning and be creative. And once I added that into my violin playing through the fusion of music and through thinking of fun costumes and movement and just really being outside the box with it, it kind of opened up this whole new world for me and made me not only refine my passion, but it made me fall like deeply in love with the craft of what I do.
But, you know, people can be very creative even if they're just sitting in their bedrooms. But you have been able to get out to the public. So it's not just creativity. I don't know if it's a great team you have, but the ability to use social media and to be able to translate what you do creatively into this mass public appeal, is that coming from you, or have you had help to get your talents out there?
I mean, of course, I have an amazing team around me of, like, you know, managers, and my tour crew has been with me for years. And we at this point are like this little team who can come up with ideas. So, you know, no artist is ever an island. You know, I can't take like the credit of being just, I completely did this on my own. But I would say those first few years, I actually did. I didn't have a management team. I didn't have, you know, a tour team. It was literally, I was a girl who had just learned a lot about film in film school.
Yeah.
And I loved storytelling. My dad was a great storyteller, and he, from the time I was a kid, would tell me stories, whether they were from his life or stories he had written. You know, he was a great writer, and it just made me fall in love with the ability to create a narrative and take someone into an imaginary place. And so when I started making my videos, that was always a very important thing to me, was what story am I going to tell, whether it was just a visual story or whether I was, you know, a ballerina stuck in a music box and I hoped that people would learn something from it or feel something from it, you know. And, you know, now I get to work with, like I said, amazing teams of people who have taken it to a whole new level with my storytelling. But to this day, I still, you know, direct my own music videos. I edit them. I creative direct my tours, just because I love, like I said, I love the creative process. And so that's such a fun part for me, is to do all these things of not only make music, but how do we bring it to life?
Way back when you awed people on America's Got Talent. And that was something, you know, before you have this big team, before you had gained a lot of the success that allows you to take the extra steps literally now. What was that like back then? Did you ever foresee that, you know, you were performing in front of millions on TV, that you would be able to take that experience and bring it home to people through YouTube, through your performances, through tours and everything else?
You know, that was really the hope when I went on to America's Got Talent. At that point, I had figured out, like, I want to do this. I want to be a performer. I want to, you know, be this little violinist, you know, that dances and travels and does shows. That's what I knew I wanted. And it was just such an interesting experience. I didn't really know anything about marketing at the time or how gaining a fan even would work. So I remember assuming that, yeah, if you're on TV in front of millions of people and you get your 15 seconds of fame, of course, that should tip the scale for you. You know, that should change everything. And suddenly I'll be able to do this. But it was really interesting once I got off that show to realize that, oh, like 15 seconds of fame is not enough to do it for people. Like, you know, the people that watched me on the show didn't necessarily follow me off of that platform of America's Got Talent. And at the time, that was a very confusing concept. I was like, wait, that's supposed to work. I'm thankful that I realized through many trial and error situations that, no, like, you have to continuously show up. You have to continuously, and not even reinvent yourself, but, like, find new ways to share your craft. You have to use the different types of, like, oh my gosh, I had to learn to be a social media expert, which I don't think anyone realizes is such a huge part of being a musician these days.
Yeah.
You kind of have to be your own marketing team and understand your brand, because no one else is going to really understand your brand except you, and you kind of train your team.
And it's such a huge category. How are you able to penetrate and differentiate? Because everyone wants to be a YouTube star, and there's so many musicians out there. And look at how you took it to a different level. We talked about Crystallize. I mentioned it. It went to number 8 on the top viewed videos in 2012, pretty quick after America's Got Talent.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I was on America's Got Talent, or when I, in the beginning, was reaching out to management companies or agents and trying to get them, like, hey, look at me. Like, do you want to book me or do you want to be my management? Nobody was really interested. And the feedback that I kept getting on all these different sources was, it's just too different. You know, like, there's no room for that. And, like, I don't know anyone who'd want to see that, is kind of the feedback I got, even though it's interesting. We just don't see a place for it. And it was really interesting, though, because then once I discovered YouTube and started putting videos up on that platform, I didn't know this at the time, but, you know, on social media, a big way to get your videos shared is to be different. And that's what the comments were on Crystallize, when people were sharing it. And, you know, they would write in the comments, like, check this out. This is so unique. I've never seen anything like this. Or this is so different. And suddenly being different went from being my biggest crutch to being my biggest asset.
Wow.
And it was just like a really interesting paradigm shift for me, and a really important moment to be like, I don't have to conform to everybody else's way of doing things. I don't have to change who I am in order to fit in. Like, the internet, if anything, you realize that there is someone for everything.
Yeah.
And you just, the higher you wave your freak flag, the more likely the other people like you are going to find you.
And it's got to be so satisfying to be who you are and to do what you want to be doing without having to change anything and to be successful. We have to take a break really quickly. When we come back, we're going to talk about Snowalt's Christmas tour and the new Christmas album that's following up on your last Christmas album, Warmer in the Winter, which hit number 1 on Christmas albums. That's quite an accomplishment. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Yeah, we got a lot of heads bopping in the studio here. That is great. Ice Storm. I mean, people just can't listen and be still. Be still. We're talking to Lindsay Sterling. Her website is lindsaysterling.com. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to the music, to the electronic violin, and see the amazing dancing along with the violin playing, and the songwriting is really incredible. It's lindsaysterling.com. She tweets at Lindsay Sterling, STIRLING. Lindsay, that's a great single. That's off the new Christmas album, Snow Waltz. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, I loved Trans-Siberian Orchestra growing up, still do. And so I wanted to do one song on there that kind of was a little bit of a head nod to my dudes at TSO. and we released it as the first single because it felt the most like it could survive outside of Christmas. And, you know, the pre-order and the first single came out in, you know, like August. And so we felt like that was a good one that could hold its own even in August.
Well, it seems like now the album's coming out October 7th. It'll have eight classic covers, five original tracks. Tell us what you're looking forward to. And of course, you have the tour coming up. But with that, who came up with the selection and how does it fit into something that I know is near and dear to your heart, Christmas?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I love Christmas and I loved like my last Christmas album. It kind of created just this cornucopia for me to create so many fun things from. You know, we've done five tours off of that album. And, you know, I've done countless music videos from it. And it just kind of was this gift that kept fueling my creativity in really fun ways. And so it was really fun to be like, well, let's do it all again. And, you know, I picked the selection of songs just based on not only my favorite Christmas tunes, but also what Christmas tunes could I imagine in like a new way? Cause you know, when you're writing Christmas covers or arranging Christmas covers, most of these have been done hundreds of times. And so it's kind of fun to think, all right, well, how can I make my version worth listening to? Why would someone want to hear 101 version of this song? And so I'm really excited about all the covers because they are completely original versions that no one's ever heard before. Very unique.
Can you tell us a little bit about what we are in store for with those covers? Because a lot of people love the music and how they are different and what kind of unique style you're going to bring to those specific covers.
Yeah. One that comes to mind first is for Feliz Navidad. Like, I've always loved how happy that Christmas song is.
Yeah, for sure.
I really wanted to lean into a very, like, push it more authentically into like a traditional Mexican style. And so I worked with actually my partner from Dancing with the Stars. He's an amazing flamenco guitar player who loves that very authentic, like, you know, flamenco, bachata rhythms. And so I worked with him to create like something that sounds like you would hear it, you know, on the streets of Mexico and almost like a little bit mariachi style. And it was really, really fun to like push that song even further into the space it came from. You know, and then Joy to the World is another one of my favorites on the album. I took it in a very Celtic direction. So it feels like, you know, something you would hear on the, you know, the plains of Ireland. You know, you can imagine castles and plaid and I don't know, all the, I love Celtic music. So it gets me really excited when I hear, you know, these big orchestral, you know, versions of these songs. And so that's why I did that one in that way. But they all kind of have that kind of a little twist on it, something slightly new.
You know, I'm just visualizing it as you're talking about it. And it seems like it's going to be some incredible choreography when you go on the Snow Waltz Christmas tour. Have you done all the choreography for these songs and the others that you'll be playing?
We're going to start soon. But I've already been working with the choreographer, letting her know, like, this is the theme of this song. This is the theme of that song. This song, imagine, you know, like, very much like letting her know and working with her on the creativity behind them. And then soon we're going to actually start working on the movements. But, like, the tour is all pretty much planned out in terms of, like, the color palettes and the, you know, the little storytelling moments and, you know, the emotional arc through the show. That's like kind of my favorite thing to work on. One of my favorite things as out of my entire artistry is getting to plan and form and mold the new show. And, you know, cause you get to, in my mind, it's like, I get to create little moments where I'm like, oh, this is one of those moments that's going to have that Disney feel to it. And, you know, the kids are going to giggle and even the adults are going to feel that childlike magic. Like I always try to plant several of those moments in the show, and it's really fun to plan which spots those are going to go in and what they're going to be.
And the wonderful thing is that it appeals to all ages, not just the hip 30-something-year-olds, but kids, older people, everyone across all of any kind of interest, because there's so much for everyone. Now, there's 2 months until the tour starts. Do you get a little stressed out that it's not going to be ready, or are you so confident that 2 months we can get it all perfect and ready to rock and roll in Texas, where you start?
You know, I used to stress out quite a bit. Like, I would really get worried as tours were approaching. You know, I had this, and I still have this idea, like, I really want to give everybody the best show that I can. I want people to leave and just be so glad that they came and that they brought their families. Like, but I feel like the only reason I'm still sane and still doing this is because I've learned to kind of let go and trust the process. And just know that, like, it's going to work out. Like, I've been working on this show for months. You know, I'm going to practice my little heart out as soon as we go into choreography rehearsals. And even though every time I start the process, it feels overwhelming and almost impossible to, like, be learning everything all over again, I just now understand that, like, it's going to happen. It's going to be great. My team is fantastic. Everybody's going to do their part. And so, like I said, I think I would have had a heart attack by now if I hadn't learned to kind of let go of some of that anxiety.
You know, it's such a great lesson because I think we can all identify with it, especially from school when we're studying for a test. You sit down and you look at the material. You don't know anything about it. How am I ever going to be prepared? And then you put in the time and effort like you're talking about. And before you know it, you have the confidence and it works out really well. And I'm sure this is going to be great, this tour. It goes from Texas, ends up here December 23rd in LA, I'm sure by design. How do you select all of the cities that the tour will hit?
Well, that is one area of my career that I'm very uninvolved in. I will say places I want to go, but it all kind of comes down to my agents, and they are really good at what they do and very strategic about it. And, you know, I've learned it's really important to trust people that are good at their part and, you know, for me to let them do their part. So yeah, that's one of the things that I have a lot less control of than people will think. And it all is just dependent on what they think is best, plus what's available and where the wind is going to take us.
I'm sure it's going to be amazing for all of you people here in L.A. It's December 23rd at the Pantages Theater, and everyone across the country, check out lindseysterling.com if you haven't seen and heard. And it's funny because when we talk about a violinist, a lot of people say, well, you have to hear her. You have to see her, too. It's really incredible, the videos, YouTube, lindseysterling.com. Lindsey, good luck with the new Christmas album, Snow Waltz, coming out October 7th, and, of course, the tour starting November 18th. Good luck with all of that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and thanks for your time and for just a delightful chat today.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, and take care. Be well.
You too. Bye.
Okay, bye. We're going to come back after this. We're going to talk to Ann Bremner and Doug Bremner about their new book, a great book called Justice in the Age of Judgment. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio KBC. Yeah, the judgment day shall come. There's a reason that we played that song. Last segment, we played Lindsey Stirling songs, and now we're talking about judgment. And I will tell you that the book we're going to talk about, Justice in the Age of Judgment, should be required reading for every law student, first of all. Hopefully it'll become a textbook through law schools throughout the country. And not only for law students, clearly for everyone to understand the climate that our legal system now faces on every case, and especially the high-profile cases that we're going to talk a little bit about. But before we talk about the book, we need to bring in our two guests, and I'll tell you, favorite guests of mine. Ann Bremner has been on our show several times. She's so giving of her time. She's very, very busy, always in the media, and she's taking care of her law practice, but she gives of her time. She's one of the world's most notable legal analysts. She's covered the Lacey Peterson, the People versus Michael Jackson, the trial of Casey Anthony. She's been
a commentator for so many other cases on networks, including CNN, Fox, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, and BBC. Prior to her work in the private sector as a defense attorney and a victims advocate, she served as a deputy criminal prosecuting attorney in King County. And along with Anne is her brother, Doug Bremner, who has amazing accolades in his own right. He taught at Yale. He teaches currently as a professor of psychiatry at Emory. He's done groundbreaking research in PTSD. He's written some incredible books. While he's a writer, he's also a doctor, so he combines it well. His books, Before You Take That Pill and You Just Can't Snap Out of It, are incredible, important reads. And both the Bremner, the family has to be so proud of brother and sister Anne Bremner and Doug Bremner. Welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Well, thanks you. Alan. It's always such a pleasure to be on with you, and what a nice introduction. I mean, I think the world of you. You're a fabulous lawyer, and it's such an honor when you ask me on, and an honor when you ask me on with my brother. So thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because last week we had Ashley Banfield on, and she said how special she feels her relationship is with you and how she respects you so much. So don't talk about me. My guests are talking about you all the time.
And I'll tell you. She's on with you, but thank you. That's so nice. She's just great. It takes the world of her, too.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if we did more doctors and psychiatrists, I'm sure they'd be saying the same thing about Doug. But, you know, as you know, most of the guests are either lawyers or in the legal field, although sometimes we move off it. A couple months ago, actually, we talked about group therapy with Molin Lesh, who wrote a book, one of the well-known books on group therapy. So we did have a psychiatrist on, and it's a pleasure, Doug, to have you back. And I know that, you know, you have a passion for writing. You've talked about it. You guys were on the show about 9 months ago or 10 months ago, maybe even more. It was October, I think, of 2021. So it's almost a year. Wow. Time flies by.
Oh, wow.
And we talked about the book, Justice in the Age of Judgment. And at that time, you were still kind of formulating things. And it's amazing how you've, in the last 11 months, have put everything together and come up with such an all-encompassing, really compelling book. Give us an update from the last time we spoke. We'll start with Anne first and then Doug. Tell us about what went into Justice in the Age of Judgments and some of the tweaks you made, because I know I looked at the differences between back then and now, and I think they were really important tweaks.
Well, what I did was I got smart and asked my brother to become far more of a writer. He's a wonderful writer. He majored in English as an undergrad, and he's written about 10 books. So the differences between when we spoke with you last, and by the way, thanks for having us on back then, and now is Doug added a number of chapters, and then I think did a nice, you know, finessing of the piece and put it together in a way that there was more of a, you know, a thesis in the book and kind of a theme of what we're trying to get across throughout. So we also put in photographs and did a little more research and dropped some things, right, Doug, and added some things. But I think what it's really attributable, I should attribute it all to Doug and not to me. I mean, he's really the one that had the laboring oar since we last spoke.
You know, you look at some of the issues, and Doug can comment on this. When you're looking at these issues like, and I know this is just part of what the book deals with, why prosecutors couldn't convict O.J. Simpson going back in time when it seemed that the evidence was overwhelming that he killed his wife, and then why a jury could remain unbiased in the overwhelming public pressure in the trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. All of these questions, and then you bring up Kyle Rittenhouse as well, who was exonerated after shooting three people. How does it happen? These are issues that may be even far more important than the evidence that is gathered in each case. Doug, comment on why
when you're writing this and you're looking at it, there isn't this overwhelming idea that maybe evidence and the truth isn't the sole focus on these trials.
Well, thanks for having me on, Alan, and thanks for all the kind words. So that was really a theme that emerged in this book, is the effect of social media on trials. And it's so much more important today because the social media is so much more involved in our life. And when I saw the verdicts come out for the Kyle Rittenhouse and Ahmaud Arbery, which, you know, Ahmaud Arbery was the man who was killed in my state of Georgia here, who there's a 911 call that said there's a black male running down the street. So he was sort of executed for jogging in the wrong neighborhood, if you will. And I saw those two verdicts. I said, how could this be? How could one get, get convicted, and, you know, the people that shot Ahmaud Arbery and the other one went free? And so I think Anne did a really good job of analyzing those two cases. And once she had given her opinion about the legal aspects, it became very clear, because we could complain about the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse can go around with an assault rifle when he's only 18 years old in the streets, but Kyle Rittenhouse wasn't actually breaking any law by doing that. And we could argue about whether it should be legal to carry an assault rifle in public, but
that wasn't the issue.
According to the law, he was acting in self-defense. Whereas in the case of Ahmaud Arbery, it was, you know, they claimed that they were making a citizen's arrest, but one of the prosecutors said, when you started it, that's not self-defense.
Yeah, you know,
exactly.
It's important. And I want to ask Anne this because, of course, you've been so involved. So much of your excellent focus over the last several years has been with the Amanda Knox case. And I remember when the book started out, you were really focused on Amanda Knox. In fact, I think it was even in the title. But it seems that when you and Doug did more research and brought in more cases, there was a realization that Amanda Knox was only one of many situations when social media, when the public perception all played such an important role in the ultimate dispositions of these cases. So tell us a little bit about how you kind of used the Amanda Knox case, but didn't just focus solely on that because of all of these other cases that Doug has alluded to.
Well, we actually, that was our premise, was talking about Amanda, because there was so much false information out there about her. I mean, in any evidence that was used in the first trial, experts on appeal and a judge said it was compromised and contaminated and inadmissible. There was nothing else. People don't know that to this day, because what was out there in the social media and the media was everything but, you know, it was the Foxy Noxy, the sex slang, she hated her roommate, you know, all this information that was just false. And you couple that with the case that's being tried in Italy, so you're not getting the true, you know, day-to-day information like we might get in Johnny Depp's trial or OJ's trial or anything else that's televised, even the Menendez trial when it was televised the first time. So we tried to basically weave her case through the chapters, so we could use that as kind of a constant theme. Like, look what happened to her, but she's not alone. You know, hers was international. It was the first probably international social media internet trial. And then we've just seen it play out in trial after trial after trial after that. Because when her case exploded, it exploded all over the internet. It was just timing.
Yeah.
Another, you know, one point that some of the chapters that were added, you know, after I got involved, is I wanted to make the case that this was a case with Amanda Knox where a prosecutor went off the rails. But this is not the only time this has happened. So we had the same thing happen in the Duke LaCrosse case and with the West Memphis 3. And the Duke LaCrosse case was all about Michael Nifong, who was a prosecutor who was running for election as a Durham County prosecutor, who used the case. He didn't even interview the alleged victim, you know, for the first 2 weeks. He used the case as a way to generate media attention for his election campaign. And these Duke LaCrosse players were unfairly charged with sexual assault of an exotic dancer that they'd hired to to dance at the party for the lacrosse team.
You know,
same with the
you went to Duke, right?
Yeah, I went to Duke. Yeah,
we won't hold that against you.
It really played into all these kind of ideas about white privilege and kind of a lot of the kind of racial divisions that came up in the O.J. Simpson case.
And I wonder, you know, recently Ken Starr passed away, and he had been a guest on our show a couple years ago. And he was involved as well in the controversy at Baylor. Are all of these kind of the same theme where it plays out in the public, not being clear at what really happens for the evidence in the cases?
That's exactly right, Alan. And I knew Ken Starr I was supposed to moderate a debate with him and Alan Dershowitz, but then they became involved in the impeachment hearing, so it didn't happen. But,
yeah, I remember, I remember you telling me that
right?
talked about that.
We did, right.
And in fact, it's funny because I had Alan Dershowitz on a few weeks ago, and I was thinking about that Ann was supposed to be, because it was kind of an interesting, juxtaposition with those two.
Exactly. And they were both lovely. And I thought Ken Starr was lovely. I mean,
it's funny how you said they were both lovely. Alan's still around, but some people would say he was more lovely some years ago than now.
Oh, I know. You're exactly right. I mean, he's like, they think he's gone to the dark side or something. They wouldn't let him hang around in like the Hamptons or whatever, or Martha's Vineyard. But I think that what we end up with is just kind of like this shredding of information and evidence that just kind of becomes, so disorganized, and you can't tell what's right, what's wrong. And who's to know, what is the true evidence in a case from what they're reading in the media? And another example is the Johnny Depp trial. That thing played out on TikTok. I mean, it was all Johnny Depp. Everybody loved Johnny Depp, right? And I think he won because he won for good reason, in my opinion. But TikTok, sure, that was trial by TikTok, in my opinion.
You know, we have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk more about justice in the age of judgment. And I want to ask you what we can take from the book in terms of moving forward. Is this something that we all just need to accept? But how will it affect justice moving forward? You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Sounds like a TikTok music for Judgment Day. We're talking about justice in the age of judgment. We have Ann Bremner and Doug Bremner. And by the way, Doug tweets at Doug_Bremner. And you can check it out. Justice in the age of judgment. Now, tell us about when people can read the book. I just got my advanced copy. I'm looking forward to it. This is going to be a great read, and I think that I want to share it with so many lawyer friends of mine, as well as my wife and other people who are just interested in understanding the whole backdrop of our justice system today, which is so different from how it was maybe 25 years ago. So tell us how people can get the book, Anne.
It's going to be available November 1st, and it's going to be available on Amazon and in bookstores. Is that right, Doug? November 1?
Yeah, November 1st, right. And it'll be on the audiobook, ebook, hardcover, and in bookstores.
Doug, how has that process been going? Has it been smooth? Because I know, you put so much effort into getting it right in the book, and then you have to deal kind of with the media, social media, getting it out so people can read. It's a completely different animal from just the intellectual approach in the book.
Well, one of the things that we did, which is new from the last time you may have seen it, is we have, we had to buy rights for photographs that went into, that illustrate each of the cases. I think the photographs really make a big difference. There's a picture of the Michael Jackson's home in California, and it really kind of, that was Neverland with the, with the kids' rides and animals, et cetera. And so it kind of, really brings home the stories quite a bit. And then there's been so much happening over the past year with these new cases with the George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Rittenhouse that you know, were really important. And so we had to research those cases and add those as well. So it did delay things, but I'm glad that we did delay, because those cases are really important, and they really highlight the theme that we've been trying to hammer home, which is the important role of media, social media, journal media, in the outcomes of these cases, and what a challenge it is to be able to render justice in this challenging age.
And I think November 1st is such a great time for a book release. It's, you know, Halloween's over, so all the spooky stuff is gone. People can start focusing on what's real in the world. And, you know, you're approaching Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's a great gift for people. And tell us a little bit about what you see is the future. Someone who is reading the book, what are they going to take away from thinking about how justice will be done moving forward, as it has been for the last several years with the social media time?
Well, I think the takeaway is you can't look at a case by a headline or a few paragraphs or one TV show or something on TikTok, you know, or anything else, because we know, and Rittenhouse is a great example, you know, what is out there may not be what's being played out in a courtroom. You know, I know it's simple and simplistic, but my favorite book is To Kill a Mockingbird. And the whole idea of the only place we're really equal is in the courtroom. Remember that? Atticus Finch said, some ladies bake better pies, and there's Rockefellers and there's paupers, you know, but we're only equal in a courtroom. We have to think about the fact that these cases are tried in courtrooms, and we have to respect that. I think it's good to televise a case in full, just like Chauvin. I mean, I think that was great. OJ, Michael Jackson wasn't televised, but let people make their own decisions. But I think the lesson is, be skeptical about what you see in the press, because it's not all press. It's like everybody is a journalist and nobody's a journalist out there in terms of how you get your news. And I think that's very important, because we can see these cases have all blown up in ways that I think that they're were potentials for injustice, like in Amanda's case, where there was true injustice, of the Duke LaCrosse case, you know, and others, that we have to be very careful, because people's lives are at stake and justice is at stake. And it's a different world today. It's a whole new world.
And, you know, you referenced To Kill a Mockingbird. Here in L.A., the production, the play, is starting shortly. It's going to be playing for a couple months here. So I don't know if you're going to be visiting, Anne, but if you are, it would be a great time to go see To Kill a Mockingbird. And
thank you.
Yeah, let me know, because I'm planning on going. So if you need someone to go with, I'm here. It's one of my favorites. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the cameras in the courtroom, it gives everyone such a different perspective, especially when they start, you know, the one that's most recent in my mind is the Johnny Depp trial, where people formed so many opinions. And I think that's what this book is focused on, is the opinions that are formed outside of seeing what goes on in the courtroom through social media and any other type of media, as well as juxtaposed with what's in the courtroom and what is really there. Doug, as a non-lawyer, as a psychiatrist, was there something that you learned from this that you kind of felt was important, but just learned more from doing the research?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Alan, is that a lot of what I learned was about legal processes and how a jury is instructed. But another interesting thing was some studies from the world of psychology, which is closer to where I am, about how people make up their mind, how people have a tendency to form a snap judgment. And one of the chapters was called, you know, the opening statement. And it was backed up with scientific studies showing that once people had made up their mind about something, it's very difficult to change that. And I was really impressed as I went in and read some of this literature, how strong that effect is. And these experiments showed that if someone was convinced that someone was good at doing a test or bad at doing a test, they continued to believe that even after you were told that this is an experiment that was designed to try and fake you out and make you think that someone was good or bad.
Yeah.
And that same thing applies to the courtroom where Zan has pointed out that she spends hours and hours preparing for the opening statement, because people will make up their mind 80% of the time based on that opening statement. And it's interesting, someone that read an advanced copy found that disturbing, that people would make up their mind before they'd actually seen the evidence. But I think good attorneys, you know, they know that,
yeah,
that initial presentation is very important.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the advanced copy, because I'm going to think about your comments, Doug, and I'm going to see if I fall into that category too. The book is called Justice in the Age of Judgment. It comes out November 1st, anywhere where you get your books, your audiobooks, or in print on Amazon. Doug Bremner, Ann Bremner, thank you so much for coming back on Gervie's Law. It's always a treat.
Such a pleasure. Thanks, Lord. You're wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck with the book, and both of you take care. Look forward to talking to you again. That's going to do it for another episode of Gervie's Law. We appreciate you listening. Next week, I believe it's Ron Say. So we'll see you then.